We are talking today with Amy Goodman. She is host of Democracy Now! And co-author of the new book, The Exception to the Rulers, Exposing Oily Politicians, War Profiteers, and the Media That Love Them. Amy, thanks for spending time with us today.
It's great to be with you.
So tell me, why the book isn't being the flagship for alternative media enough?
It's about recognizing the full media landscape in this country. I host Democracy Now!, which is the largest public media collaboration in the country. Over 220 Pacifica radio stations, NPR stations, public access TV stations, now PBS, and Free Speech TV, which is on Dish Network, Channel 9415, broadcast Democracy Now!, which is a daily, unembedded, grassroots, international, independent news hour. So we broadcast on over 220 radio and television stations around the country, across Canada on radio, across Australia on radio, and in Europe. It is astounding, the explosion and growth of the show, 2 to 3 stations a week picking us up, I think because of the hunger, I should say starvation, people feeling starved for independent voices. The title of the book, The Exception to the Rulers, is the motto of Democracy Now!, but it should describe all media in this country. The exception to the rulers. There's a reason why our profession, journalism, is enshrined in, is protected by the U.S. Constitution, and the only one. Because we are the check and balance on government. And that is what the media has fallen so far short of. In fact, I would say right now, the corporate media in this country has reached an all-time low, and that's why we felt it was urgent to write this book.
Give us a little history of Democracy Now! When did it start?
Well, I'm from Pacifica Radio, and I came to Pacifica almost 20 years ago. Pacifica was founded in 1949, 55 years ago, by a World War II conscientious objector named Lou Hill. He came out of the detention camps, having refused to fight, and said there has to be a media outlet that's run not by corporations that profit from war, but by journalists and artists. And that's how Pacifica was born. Not by corporations, as George Gerbner, founder of the Cultural Environment Movement, a journalism professor, said, not by corporations that have nothing to tell and everything to sell that are raising our children today. KPFA was the first station. Berkeley, California, April 15th, 1949, 3 o'clock in the afternoon, Lou Hill welcomed people to the airwaves of FM, which was in its infancy. So they actually had to give out FM radios that they built. And then, of course, as soon as people started to listen, they're asking for money. Because Pacifica pioneered the idea of listener sponsorship. The idea that we won't turn to corporations, but we'll turn to the listener. If you like what you hear, please pledge, please support what you're listening to. NPR later adopted that, PBS adopted that. And then Pacifica grew to 5 stations, KPFK in Los Angeles, WBAI in New York, where I come from, WPFW in Washington, and KPFT in Houston. In 1970, when KPFT went on the air, it's the only radio station in the country whose transmitter was blown up by the Ku Klux Klan twice. And when the exalted Cyclops, or do you call him the Grand Dragon? I get confused. But anyway, he later said it was his proudest act. And I think that's because he understood how dangerous Pacifica is. Dangerous because it allows people to speak for themselves. And when you hear someone speaking from their own experience, that breaks down bigotry and hatred, the stereotypes and the caricatures that fuel groups like these. So in the 50s, Paul Robeson, the great actor, singer, scholar, activist, when he was whitelisted from almost every public space in this country, but a few black churches, knew he could be heard on KPFA. James Baldwin, the great civil rights activist and writer, debating Malcolm X on the effectiveness of nonviolent civil disobedience, broadcast over the airwaves of WBAI. Pacifica Archives has the largest Fannie Lou Hamer recording collection anywhere. It's the history of grassroots activism of the last half century in this country. And Democracy Now!, we started in 1996 as the first daily election show in public broadcasting, the year Clinton got elected for the second time. And it was going to end after 9 months when the election happened. But there was such an outcry for it to go on because, well, I didn't just focus on electoral politics because, let's face it, more than half the people in this country don't vote. I wanted to know, well, what are people doing? I mean, if you're not voting in this election year, and yet I don't think people are apathetic, what are you involved with? And so that's what we looked at, too. What was the kind of engagement people were involved with? And this focus on non-officialdom, on grassroots voices, I think now has only, the interest in it has only grown because the media, unfortunately, the corporate media, has become such a spokesperson for those in power when we're supposed to be exactly the opposite, has become a conveyor belt for the lies of this administration and for other administrations, but this one's in power right now. And that has got to change. Because if you look at the quagmire, you look at the disaster, the horror that is Iraq right now, that means being a conveyor belt for the lies. Those lies take lives. It really matters what the media does in this country.
Let's go into the subtitle of your book, Exposing Oily Politicians, is one piece of that. Is that something that's new to the current administration and tied into their incredible pasts in oil companies?
Well, first, I don't want people to think it's what Amazon.com said. Even before I swear we wrote the book, they had it online to pre-order, although I encourage people especially to go to independent bookstores like Elliott Bay. But online, it said, those people interested in this book might also be interested in acne and wrinkle products. And the reason is they underlined the word oily, exposing oily politicians. So no, we're not going into a sideline of skincare cream, but exposing oily politicians. I would say that this administration, what we call it in the exception to the rulers, the ascendancy of the oiligarchy. You've got George Bush, who's a failed oil man. You've got Dick Cheney, former head of the largest oil services corporation in the world. You've got Condoleezza Rice, who was on the board of Chevron for a decade and had a Chevron oil tanker named after her, the Condoleezza Rice, name only taken off when it became too embarrassing, even after she was national security advisor. Don Evans, head of commerce, he headed up an oil company before. Andrew Card, the chief of staff, was a former GM lobbyist. Spencer Abraham, head of energy, was the largest recipient of oil company or automotive campaign contributions as a one-time senator. So I think that rates as the oiligarchy. And it's a grave concern, especially when you look at, for example, the situation in Iraq. You know, Counterpunch.org had reported that the Pentagon had come up with another title for the invasion of Iraq. We know it's Operation Iraqi Freedom. But they had come up with one before that, which was Operation Iraqi Liberation. But they had to toss it because the acronym was OIL, oil. I think oil is behind a lot today, behind a lot of pain.
Yeah, certainly some argue that oil isn't the only reason we're over there, but it's obviously way ahead of whatever's in second place.
You're right. It's complex why we're over there for a number of reasons. Oil certainly is high up there. Iraq sits on the second largest oil fields in the world next to Saudi Arabia. And now, especially when you look at what's going on in a place like Fallujah, where they were talking about putting in one of Saddam Hussein's major generals to be in charge. No, I'm not talking about the insurgents. I'm talking about the U.S. government was putting in to be in charge of Fallujah. And then you look at the horror that is Abu Ghraib right now and the torture and all of that. Yeah, you have a change of regime, perhaps a change of the country that's in charge. But then you have to look at, well, what is the U.S. doing then but running, taking the natural resources and then giving back, in the case of Fallujah, the power to the people who were there before. Once that was exposed, though, that he was a major general, Saddam Hussein, the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff quickly said, well, we haven't decided that he's going to be that. And, of course, we see what happens when they get exposed.
Currently, as we speak, Donald Rumsfeld is before the Congress trying to backpedal on some of the stuff that has come up this week in terms of U.S. soldiers and contractors torturing Iraqi civilians in jail. Have you been surprised by the amount of corporate media attention to this story?
When the pictures get out, it has an enormous effect. It's what we've been saying for over a year. Where have been the pictures of war, of invasion? Dead children splattered on the ground, women with their legs blown off by a cluster bomb. If we had seen these from the beginning, I believe that war would have been abolished. We see now these horrifying pictures of torture, sexual degradation of men in prison, hearing about women in prison too, degraded. It's the pictures, though, because the administration could have denied it with all of the reports, could have still denied it. The pictures matter. And when they leak out, the whole world is repulsed. You know, there's this emphasis on the anger in the Arab world. It's not just the Arab world. Everyone is repulsed, as if they have a kind of special, unique sensitivity. Now, in one sense, of course, the unbelievable degradation, but this is a human thing. And in the exception to the rulers, we have chapter after chapter, for example, one, sanitized. I interviewed Aaron Brown on Democracy Now! For an hour. I think he hails from here, from Seattle.
He does.
And asked him, where are the pictures? You know, CNN knows exactly what they're doing because they have two networks. They've got CNN International and CNN Domestic. They're very different in what they convey. As Noam Chomsky says, the media here manufactures consent. They manufacture consent for war. Every day, according to Aaron Brown, they all met in the well in Atlanta deciding what to do, and that was CNN International and CNN. CNN International showing other pictures, showing the pictures. Take the day that the statue of Saddam Hussein was pulled down by U.S. troops. You know, you never saw the actual troops pulling them. You just saw the rope. They were right out of the camera view. Pulled down by U.S. troops. And that statue went up through the day on all the networks and down, up, down, up, down, almost bestowing supernatural powers on Saddam Hussein. Down, up, down, up. And it became the symbol. CNN Domestic ran that all day. CNN International also ran that. But they ran a split screen. On one side of the screen, yes, they ran the statue going up and down. The other half, they showed the casualties of war. So that says that CNN knows exactly what they're doing. They knew that internationally, the viewing public would not buy the sanitizing of war because they were seeing it all over the place in other networks. We label the showing of the pictures, the U.S. Bush administration, as propaganda. But what is it but the truth? I'm not for the whole trend in reality TV. I don't go for that whole thing. But I do think we need a little reality TV when it comes to the invasion of Iraq. Let's face it. The picture we saw leading up to the invasion, constantly a target on the forehead of Saddam Hussein, is not accurate when you're looking at an invasion and war. Because the overwhelming number of civilians, of people who die in war, are civilians. What would have been much more accurate would have been a target on the forehead of a little Iraqi girl. And that's what we have to recognize. That's what these pictures show us now. The power of the images, and the Bush administration knows exactly that power. It's what they've tried to stop for a long time. It's why President Bush has enforced that executive order against photographing or videotaping the coffins and the body bags of soldiers coming home. They know that the American public will not accept this. And in the same way, these images of Iraqi men naked, wearing hoods, having leashes put on them. I mean, horrific pictures. Dead men and live men, hard to tell who is what. No, this is a crisis for this administration, only because the media is finally showing what they should have been showing for a very long time. Yes, we're talking about more than 740 U.S. soldiers dead and more than 11,000 Iraqi civilians dead. The media has to be called to account for this as well.
So how do you see the investigation? We don't even have an investigation yet. Do you see an investigation with any serious digging going on?
Well, let's look at the 9/11 Commission. It's called the Independent Commission. And what last happened? President Bush, together with his vice president, Dick Cheney, testified before it at the White House. They said it couldn't be recorded. It couldn't be transcribed. And when the commission, the independent commissioners left, they had their notes seized. Bipartisan, yes. It's both parties. That doesn't mean independent. Condoleezza Rice, when she testified before the 9/11 Commission, the whole issue was, and I was quite surprised the media didn't make more of this, though they did focus, and it shows when the media spotlight is focused in the right place, immediately stuff gets done. The issue wasn't, would she talk? She was talking on all the networks. Would she talk under oath? In other words, would she tell the truth? And, you know, she was following the orders of the Bush administration. The president, of course, didn't have to speak under oath, I guess, didn't have to tell the truth. And then you ask about what's going to happen here. Donald Rumsfeld saying that he'll set up a panel. Uh-huh. We better do something. The fact is that Rumsfeld has known about this not since the photos came out. Rumsfeld has known about this for many, many months and has told the president. They're doing something about this now because the pictures have come out and there are many more to come, still and video.
And we've seen things similar to this with relating to Guantanamo, photos that came out there, and yet there was never any uproar over that again because I believe the corporate media didn't choose to carry any of those. But
yes, I mean, you're raising an important point. Guantanamo, we don't even know what has gone on at Guantanamo yet. Afghanistan? On Democracy Now!, we ran a documentary by a former BBC producer called Afghan Massacre, Convoy of Death, that aired all over Europe, didn't get aired here, except when we did it on Democracy Now! We premiered it in the United States, and it was an unbelievable hour of the story of prisoners of war in Afghanistan being transported in suffocating, overcrowded trucks to an area of land where not only did many die in the trucks and en route, but then the Afghan soldiers who were working with U.S. special forces shot into the trucks. This is a story that's hardly been touched here in this country. There is so much that has to be uncovered. Afghanistan, Iraq, Guantanamo. And there's another part of this that hasn't gotten a lot of attention. Who are these guys at Abu Ghraib? They didn't get a lot of training, they say. That really astounds me. You see these disgusting pictures of Iraqi men stripped naked, of having bags put over the head, looking, posing in sexual acts with each other, being forced to do this unbelievably degrading stuff. And some of the reports saying, well, they didn't get human rights training. Oh, and now we didn't get human rights training either, but do we need human rights training to know that this is wrong? They didn't get human rights training. But the story of who these people are, first of all, it goes way beyond six or seven individuals, whatever these pictures show. Cy Hirsch, a very important piece in The New Yorker, exposing a lot of this. We're talking about the military police. We're talking about military intelligence. We're talking about the Pentagon, also the privatizing of the military. Military contractors, and we're hearing it in the hearings with Donald Rumsfeld now as the senators are questioning. Wait a second. You have the interrogators are from private companies? The people who are breaking down human beings have been hired? What accountability do they have? A lot is being exposed now. And the stories of some of these men and women, one of them, he was put in charge, one of the people in charge brought over to Abu Ghraib because he was a corrections guard in Virginia for 6 years. Now, what does that say about our prison system? And also in Pennsylvania at SCI Green, I know, because that's where Mumia Abu-Jamal is on death row there, and we've broadcast his voice. We talk about the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal and the exception to the rulers, hearing from people on death row, hearing from people in the prisons. We're not here to run popularity, win popularity contests. We're here to show the reality, to go into these public institutions and see what's going on. If we don't have public watchdogs, which is the press, how will we know what's happening? It's so frightening what's happening at Abu Ghraib right now. But given that it's U.S. military and civilian contractors that are running it, you have to ask where they come from and what it says about what we have here at home.
Democracy Now, in a lot of ways, has been a catalyst towards getting some of these stories out. And again, I kind of have a fear with this current situation, the current story, that we're going to see it in the papers for another week or so, and then it's going to die out and people are going to forget about it. What do you see citizens' roles to be able to change that?
All the power is with us. All the power was with the American people. We live in the most powerful country on earth. You know, we begin and end the exception to the rulers with East Timor, a place that I have covered for many years. Noam Chomsky wrote about it from 1975 when Indonesia invaded, day before Henry Kissinger, Secretary of State, and then President Ford went to Indonesia, gave the go-ahead for the invasion. 90% of the weapons were from the United States. And the Indonesian military invaded by land, by air, and by sea, killing off the people of Timor. I went there in 1990 and 1991 with Alan Nairn, an investigative journalist. He was writing for The New Yorker at the time, November 12, 1991. We covered a procession of thousands of Timorese who were protesting yet another young man who died at the hands of the Indonesian military, and they were outside the cemetery. Girls in their Catholic school uniforms, old women in their traditional Timorese garb, boys in their shorts. And from the direction the procession had come, hundreds of Indonesian soldiers carrying their US M16s, marching up 12 to 15 abreast. They came up the road, and we saw that they were coming, and Alan and I were interviewing people. Why are you here? This is a place where there's no freedom of speech, no freedom of assembly, no freedom of the press. Why have you walked here? We said to the protesters, to the people in the procession, why are you risking your life? For my mother, they said, for my father, for the village that's been wiped out. The Indonesian military killed a third of the population in Timor from 75 until now. The Indonesian military committed one of the great genocides of the 20th century. It hardly got covered by the U.S. press for many, many years because the Indonesian government was an ally of the U.S. Unlike Pol Pot's Cambodia, an enemy of the U.S., so the president would always talk about it and the media covered it. This is how the media works. In a case where a country is the ally, they rarely expose what goes on inside. And so we didn't know about Timor for years, most people. So on that moment, November 12th, 1991, thousands of Timorese in the street can't get away because there are walls on either side of the road, soldiers marching up, Alan and I interviewing people. We see the soldiers coming. We think maybe we can head off this attack if we show them that we're journalists. We knew they'd committed many massacres in the past, but never in front of Western journalists, so this time for the first time. I took out my headphones from my bag, put them on, held up my microphone like a flag. Alan put the camera above his head. We never showed our equipment because it would endanger Timorese caught talking to reporters. This time we wanted to make very clear who we were, and we walked to the front of the crowd. The soldiers marched up, 12 to 15 abreast, USM 16s at the ready. They swept around the corner without any warning, without any provocation, without any hesitation. They swept past us, and they opened fire on the crowd, gunning people down from right to left. The first to go down, little boy, hands up in the V-sign, explodes from the gunfire, and they keep on shooting. They beat me to the ground with their rifle butts and their boots, and Alan threw himself on top of me to protect me from further injury. They took their USM-16s like baseball bats, and they slammed them against his skull until they fractured it. We were lying in the road. A group of soldiers put the guns to our heads, firing squad fashion. They were killing everyone around us. And they started screaming, "Politique, politique," because to witness something like this is political. Journalists bear witness. And they shouted, "Australia, Australia." We were asking, "Are we from Australia?" We knew 17 years before, right before Indonesia invaded, there were six reporters from two Australian TV crews that were covering the events leading up to the invasion. They took five of them, put them up against a house, and executed them all. The sixth, Roger East, was in a radio station in Dili reporting for the World the day after the invasion. They dragged him out of the radio station And as he shouted, "I'm from Australia," they shot him into the harbor. The Australian government hardly protested. Years later, I think it was explained by the Indonesian-Australian government signing the Timor Gap Treaty that would divide up Timor's oil between Australia and Indonesia. Oil is the source of so much pain in the world. And so as we lay on the road 17 years later, November 12, 1991, soldiers, guns at our heads, more joining, we said, "No, we're from America, America." They'd stripped us now of everything. I only had my passport. I threw it at them. They would kick me in the stomach. When I got my wind back, I'd say, "America, America." And at some point, they decided to take the guns from our heads. We think because we were from the same country their weapons were from, they would have to pay a price they'd never paid for killing the Timorese. And they moved on, picking people off between the tombstones and killing them. We got into a Red Cross Jeep. We were able to drive off. Dozens of Timorese jumped on top of us, on top of the van. We drove off as a human mass to the hospital. When we got to the hospital, the doctors and nurses started to cry when they saw us. Not because we were in worse shape than the Timorese. They killed more than 270 Timorese on that day. But because of what we represent to the people, not only of Timor, and this goes to your question of what people can do in this country. I think Americans represent two things to people all over the world, the sword and the shield. The sword because all too often the U.S. government provides weapons to repressive regimes, but also the shield because Americans come from the most powerful country on earth and people really do turn to us. The littlest thing we do in this country, calling a congressman, writing a letter to an editor, has a huge ripple effect, amplifying effect around the world. And the doctors and nurses on that day saw that shield bloodied, and it only deepened their despair. Fast forward 10 years. May 20th, 2002, Alan Aaron and I got to return to Timor to celebrate with the people there, their freedom. A few years before, they got what they had asked for, that whole period of the occupation. Let us vote, and we will decide our own future. And the UN sponsored a referendum, and they voted overwhelmingly for their independence. And May 20th, 2002 was Independence Day. We stood outside Dili, the capital of Timor, in a sandy plain called Tasitolo. 100,000 Timorese gathered. At midnight, May 19th into 20th, the founding president of East Timor, the longtime rebel leader who'd been imprisoned for years by the Indonesian military, ascended the stage and raised the flag of the Democratic Republic of East Timor. As this nation of survivors looked up into the sky and saw the fireworks display, we saw the light reflected in their tear-stained faces. This nation of survivors had prevailed. They had resisted and they had won. And they knew that they couldn't have done it without the goodwill of people all over the world, who when they learned, when the media spotlight finally was shed on their plight, people across the political spectrum told their governments, "No, you cannot arm repressive regimes." And that was an incredible lesson that we all take from that experience. They won their freedom, but at an unbelievably high price, a third of the population killed. But the lesson is, I think, for us, that we have a decision to make in this country. I mean, a year or two ago, I interviewed a woman from Guyana about globalization. And at the end of our conversation, I said, "We're turning now to a conversation about the U.S. elections. Thank you very much for joining us." And she said, "I'll be joining you for that conversation." And I said, "Well, no, actually, we're done with our conversation. I have other guests for that conversation." She said, "And I'll be one of those guests." And I said, "Oh, really? Why?" And she said, "Because I believe everyone in the world should get to vote for president of the United States." And it's such an interesting point because that one person affects more people in the world than any other. What we do here in this country deeply matters to the rest of the world. It is way beyond isolated countries. Yes, we are all globalized. We are a global community. And whether or not folks care about who is president of the United States or feel maybe that there isn't much difference in the candidates, at the local level it matters. You can start building your own communities, your own candidates that do represent you. And it does matter how we deal with the world, starting with our own communities. And what I learned through that experience of Timor is that every hour of every day we have a decision to make, whether we want to represent the sword or the shield.
Yeah, I know here locally, groups like ETAN were very key in that. And I know people within those groups that would regularly come and, you know, lobby to talk on my show here.
That's right. I mean, East Timor Action is an amazing grassroots organization. What an incredible model. They're the ones who educated the people of this country from the massacre of 91 on. Their approach was two-pronged. One was community education. When there would be a movie that would be shown, they would table, they would gather names so that they would get a mailing list. They could send information out to do alerts and talk to the press, educate the press. Because, I mean, so often, it's not that people are ignorant. People are very smart. But if the media doesn't shine a spotlight over there, how are they supposed to know? And they lobbied in Washington, continually both educating congressmen and senators and then lobbying for legislation that would cut off military sales to repressive regimes like Indonesia. They're a remarkable group, and East Timor Action Network was strong here.
So do you see grassroots efforts like that as being far more important than, in some ways, than what our elected officials are doing?
Or? Well, they force the hand of elected officials. They can educate elected officials. Nothing beats citizen activism, citizen and non-citizen activism in this day and age of the crackdown after September 11th on non-citizens, but people joining together to educate each other and educate the leaders, leading the leaders, and then perhaps becoming those leaders.
That seems like something we need to focus a lot more on in this upcoming election. So much talk about who the president is going to be, very little talk about these other positions that are open. And, for instance, the races for Congress, where I'm not sure exactly how many are potentially shifting over, but you don't hear about that.
They make a huge difference, too. I mean, we're talking about every level of government, and it means people being informed, being active, whether on their PTA, their school board, their city council, their state legislature, right on up to president. And then when you look at these presidential candidates, when you look at someone like John Kerry, you see what a difference it makes what people say and how engaged they are. Because look at how he's run his campaign. You had Howard Dean out ahead, big anti-war candidate. And you had John Kerry, who voted for the invasion of Iraq. So did John Edwards. And yet Howard Dean is winning. And John Kerry is smart. And he says, whoa, I'm not going to get this nomination if I don't start looking at who's out ahead. And so he started giving what Howard Dean said were Howard Dean's speeches. Only he actually looked better giving them. And he was giving Howard Dean's speeches better than Howard Dean was. And so he takes the lead. He stops running against Howard Dean. He's running with Howard Dean. And he does it a little better. And he wins. And he's the presumptive Democratic nominee. Now there's no Howard Dean to contend with, or Dennis Kucinich, of course. He has always believed this, but the media doesn't focus on him. So now he's running against George Bush, or is it with George Bush? He seems to be adopting the same approach. He sees George Bush ahead, so he is taking his platforms. You're going, whoa, wait a second. We want to see two people opposed, and you decide whose view is closer to yours. So we see John Kerry saying he wants to send more troops to Iraq. We see John Kerry interviewed on Tim Russert's Meet the Press when asked about Bush supporting Israeli Prime Minister Sharon in the assassination of the Hamas leader. He says he agrees. You have Japan, England, Germany, France all condemning this action. Assassination? Is this the approach, extrajudicial killing? Or do you try these people? And if they are guilty, you deal with them. I mean, it definitely endangers U.S. officials and U.S. soldiers if we become the model of how to deal in the world, extrajudicial killings. But he's saying he agrees with this. He agrees with, on the issue of the Middle East, Sharon's approach, no right of return for the Palestinians, the settlements taking extremely hard line. And he agrees with Bush supporting Sharon. So even, you know, General Electric NBC's Tim Russert says, you agree with George Bush? Yes. Completely? Yes, he says. And then you've got the attack on Kerry's record, not to be confused with Bush's non-record in Vietnam, Kerry's record on Vietnam. Here is a young Kerry who goes to fight in Vietnam, comes out as highly decorated, and eloquently speaks out against the Vietnam War, becomes Nixon's one of his chief enemies. He's terrified of this young John Kerry because he's a highly decorated officer, and yet he's speaking out, speaking before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. I think it was April 22nd, 1971, one of the most eloquent speeches you could ever hear against war. Yes, also talking about atrocities committed by U.S. soldiers in Vietnam. Incredible. We ran it. It came from the Pacifica archives. I think we have the only complete version of this speech. Yet I do think perhaps that John Kerry might think that that was a show against him because we ran his speech. Why? Because he seems to be backing off his own record. When Bush attacks, and it's astounding that Bush would have what is called the chutzpah to attack John Kerry on his Vietnam record, given that he tried to get out of it by being in the Texas National Guard and even tried then was out of the guard that he was using to get out of Vietnam, never even showed up. He attacks Kerry on his record. You'd think that Kerry would have plenty of, I hate to use the word, ammunition to fight back. Yet he then backtracks on his own anti-war activism. What a lesson Kerry would teach this country. He said, yes, I went there. I recognize it was a mistake. I came back, and I proclaimed it from everywhere I could. Instead, he backs off and says, well, it wasn't medals I threw, it was ribbons, medals, ribbons. If he lets Bush define the agenda, and he agrees with that agenda, no one will do it better than Bush. Why vote for someone who's just adopting that record? Bush knows what he's doing. He's going for his own base. Kerry seems to be abandoning his base and going for Bush's base. Well, Bush has his base much better than Kerry does. So I think it does matter what people say now, that whole philosophy ABB, anything but Bush. Because if people adopt that approach and don't hold the politician accountable, clearly Kerry can adopt any position, just depending on what the people want. He has shown it over the years. So it does matter what people demand of him right now.
Let me ask you, since you have covered so many stories that have led the way for both independent media and corporate media, talking about Kerry, talking about Bush, I don't think either of them is coming up with a lot of their own strategies. They have people hired, they have people on their team, and even those team members are getting their strategies told to them from others. Do you think that we're ever really going to address the real power structure in this country, which I'm not even sure I know what it is, but clearly it's not, the president of this country is not the top man, you know, running things.
Are you suggesting that when he went into the 9/11 commission hearing and he had to take the vice president, that there was some power sharing that was going on there? Dick Cheney, the former head of the largest oil services corporation in the world, what's happening in Iraq, yes, a horror, and yet Halliburton, Bechtel, these private companies making a killing off the killing. The permanent government, you're talking about, you know, who are those who remain in Washington. It doesn't matter if it's Democrat or Republican. I mean, let's look at, you know, the hugest media consolidation in this country's history taking place right now, the concentration of media ownership. So many channels, and yet what matters is who owns them. The media moguls like Rupert Murdoch taking over so much, devouring the commercial and non-commercial smaller stations. And you look at the clear channeling of America. We write about this in The Exception to the Rulers. You know, the small company, first a couple dozen stations, now more than 1,200 stations in the country. Yes, that's under Bush, and it's a very Bush-connected communications company. Sponsors pro-war rallies, doesn't allow anti-war songs from being played. The South Carolina Broadcaster of the Year broadcast on Clear Channel, and she was fired. She didn't want to go to the pro-war rallies. She was anti-war. She dared to express her view on the radio. You might say, see, this is what happens under Bush. This is what happens under Michael Powell, who's chair of the FCC, son of Colin Powell, who leads the war in Iraq. His son leads the war on diversity of voices here at home. But that consolidation started not under Bush, but under Clinton and Gore. 1996, the Telecommunications Act, Clear Channel, a few dozen stations. It just explodes. after the Telecommunications Act that was so heralded by Gore and Clinton. Yeah, it's very important to look at the lack of spectrum of opinion between the Democrats and the Republicans. Grassroots activism matters. And even when Michael Powell tried to adopt these new rules that he has managed to do, but with tremendous adversity, that would launch the largest media consolidation in this country, and the networks almost don't cover it at all, they're behind the scenes filing briefs in support, joint briefs in support of this media deregulation. You thought they were competitors, NBC, ABC, CBS? No, please think again. Still, people got word through Pacifica, through alternative means. We would cover all these informal hearings held by the two dissident commissioners and unions and media activist groups. 1,000 people would come out over obscure rule changes. I mean, what? The FCC? How much percentage you can penetrate of the American public if you're a network? And yet people had a gut reaction. No. We can't have the newspaper, radio, and television in a town owned by the same person, the same company, or we'll only get one view. I do think grassroots activism matters. And then you had everyone from Trent Lott to Barbara Boxer taking on Michael Powell, raking him over the coals. People have a gut feeling about protecting democracy. It doesn't matter if you're Republican or you're a progressive. You care about corporate control, about invasions of our privacy, about U.S. soldiers dying in Iraq by the hundreds, about Iraqi civilians dying as well. And I think we're seeing a real reconfiguring of alliances and where people stand in this country. And I think it is a time for grassroots activism like we've never seen before.
Yes, I'm often reminded of what I was told was a Chinese curse, may you live in interesting times, and I think that we do.
Yeah. And another, you know, the word for danger in Chinese is two characters. One is crisis and the other is opportunity. And we are living in very dangerous times, but it means that there is a huge opening for true grassroots leaders to take the lead. In the exception to the rulers, we are talking about being the exception to the rulers, and that is what will shore up democracy. We have a chapter in the book called Things Get Messy with Sally Jesse, and it was my experience being on the Sally Jesse Raphael show during the Persian Gulf War. Well, I'll leave it to people to read the book before I tell all the details of this remarkable hour where Sally broke down, stopped the taping of the show. Her producers came out and rocked her back and forth, said, "It's okay, Sally, it's okay," as if she'd never heard an anti-war voice before. There were 6 of us women, 3 pro-war, 3 anti-war. But finally, as we continued with the taping, I went back to WBAI afterwards. They said the show would air in a few days, and it didn't air. And lots of people called into the show and finally got it to air. But it ran with headlines because they had held on to it and tried to censor it, that said, "Things Get Messy with Sally Jesse." But the most interesting response I got was from women on Southern military bases who called to say, "We agree with you, and we've never heard this view on television before." And they said, "We can't have these debates on military bases. They rely on us in civilian society, and I see the media as a kitchen table that stretches across this country, that we all sit around and debate and dialogue and discuss the most important issues of the day, war and peace, life and death. And anything less than that is a disservice to the servicemen and women of this country. We need a media that is there to serve a democratic society. They, CBS, NBC, ABC, are using the public airways too. They don't own that. It is not private property. It is a national treasure. And all of us must protect this treasure and use it wisely."
All right. And what steps do you recommend people, besides tuning into your excellent program, Democracy Now!, what steps do you recommend people to take?
Well, get involved with the media. Whether you do other things, you say, "Well, I can't actually come to KEXP and do a program." Well, be media literate. When you see something that you object to, I was just interviewing Bert Sachs, a local Seattle activist, right, who went to Iraq 9 times. And he is running a whole campaign, a committee for responsible journalism. He says he listens to Democracy Now! At 6 in the morning, if it's okay to say another station, because I think all of us in public media have to shore each other up, have to pledge to KEXP and to KBCS, all of the stations together, because if we don't use these spaces, we will lose them. Says he listens to Democracy Now! And KBCS, and then he reads the papers, the Seattle Times, the Seattle Post-Intelligencer, and he sees, for example, when we're reporting on Fallujah, talking about the 600 Iraqis dead, the doctors and nurses saying many of them are women and children and older men, and the Seattle Post-Intelligencer reports this, but from an AP report, but the Seattle Times leaves out the sentence about the civilians that are dying. And so you go, you talk to the editor, you encourage reporters to go to these places. What I say is the role of reporters to go to where the silence is. And yes, remember, these newspapers are companies. They care about their consumers. And if you're educated, if you educate yourself, a group of people, perhaps a church group, a community group said, I want more coverage. These are some of the experts in the community. Don't just go to those that small circle of pundits who know so little about so much. There are experts in our communities, and to make demands, both in newspaper and in radio and television, they do respond. And then make your own media if you can. You hear you're filming and you're doing this program. You're working both in public radio and on public access TV. In the same way that people establish public radio, the media activist has wrested this little public space, a few public interest channels in each community from the media monopolies like Comcast, Adelphia, whatever you have in your community, AOL, Time Warner. Only one of them can rip up the roads in a town because we don't want all of them doing it, or we won't be able to drive anywhere. Maybe that would be a good thing. But so they get the monopoly in a town. But in exchange, they have to give over a few channels to us, to the public, and we can make our own media there. But when they renegotiate their contracts with the city council, the state legislature, they try to, well, bring down maybe three public interest channels to one. And if no one's using them, no one's going to raise a peep of protest. But if we are using them, so no, we rely on that for the city council hearing. No, we rely on that to see our programs. We're Democracy Now! Broadcasts on over 100 public access TV stations around the country. The response is incredible. They have picked up viewership. And then people want to go and maybe do a show after or before and discuss the issues in it. And suddenly it becomes a channel that in a community people know they can turn to that reflects their own community. We have to use all the public spaces or we will lose them. Also the internet and communicate with each other. I think there's tremendous hope in grassroots independent media in this country.
All right. Well, with that, we are unfortunately out of time. We have been talking with Amy Goodman. She is host of Democracy Now! And the co-author of the brand new book, The Exception to the Rulers, Exposing Oily Politicians, War Profiteers, and the Media That Love Them. Amy, thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much. And I wrote the book with my brother, David Goodman, who is also a journalist and writes for publications like Mother Jones, Washington Post, and other publications. And it was a great privilege to write it with my own brother. Thank you.